to sort of group mind. And Eldon and Rachel Rosen consisted as spokesmen for that corporate entity. His mistake, evidently, had been in viewing them as individuals. It was a mistake he would not make again. "Your superior, Mr. Bryant," Eldon Rosen said, "will have difficulty understanding how you happened to let us void your testing apparatus before the test began." He pointed toward the ceiling, and Rick saw the camera lens. His massive error in dealing with the Rosens had been recorded. "I think the right thing for us all to do," Eldon said, "is sit down and..." He gestured affably. "We can work something out, Mr. Deckard. There's no need for anxiety. The Nexus 6 variety of android is a fact. We here at the Rosen Association recognize it, and I think now you do too." Rachel, leaning toward Rick, said, "How would you like to own an owl?" "I doubt if I'll ever own an owl." But he knew what she meant. He understood the business the Rosen Association wanted to transact. Tension of a kind he had never felt before manifested itself inside him. It exploded leisurely in every part of his body. He felt the tension, the consciousness of what was happening, take over completely. "But an owl," Eldon Rosen said, "is the thing you want." He glanced at his niece inquiringly. "I don't think he has any idea." "Of course he does," Rachel contradicted. "He knows exactly where this is heading. Don't you, Mr. Deckard?" Again she leaned toward him, and this time closer. He could smell a mild perfume about her, almost a warmth. "You're practically there, Mr. Deckard. You practically have your owl." To Eldon Rosen, she said, "He's a bounty hunter, remember? So he lives off the bounty he makes, not his salary. Isn't that so, Mr. Deckard?" He nodded. "How many androids escaped this time?" Rachel inquired. Presently, he said, 8. Originally. 2 have already been retired by someone else. Not me." "You get how much for each android?" Rachel asked. Shrugging, he said, "It varies." Rachel said, "If you have no test you can administer, then there is no way you can identify an android. And if there's no way you can identify an android, there's no way you can collect your bounty. So if the Voight-Kampff scale has to be abandoned..." "A new scale," Rick said, "will replace it. This has happened before. 3 times, to be exact. But the new scale, the more modern analytical device, had been there already. No lag had existed. This time was different." "Eventually, of course, the Voight-Kampff scale will become obsolete," Rachel agreed. "But not now. We're satisfied ourselves that it will delineate the Nexus 6 types, and we'd like you to proceed on that basis in your own particular, peculiar work." Rocking back and forth, her arms tightly folded, she regarded him with intensity, trying to fathom his reaction. "Tell him he can have his owl," Eldon Rosen grated. "You can have the owl," Rachel said, still eyeing him. "The one up on the roof. Scrappy. But we will want to mate it if we can get our hands on a male. And any offspring will be ours. That has to be absolutely understood." Rick said, "I'll divide the brood."
"No,"
Rachel said instantly. Behind her, Eldon Rosen shook his head, backing her up. That way you'd have claim to the sole bloodline of owls for the rest of eternity. And there's another condition. You can't will your owl to anybody. At your death, it reverts back to the association. That sounds, Rick said, like an invitation for you to come in and kill me. To get your owl back immediately. I won't agree to that. It's too dangerous.
You're a bounty hunter, Rachel said. You can handle a laser gun. In fact, you're carrying one right now. If you can't protect yourself, how are you going to retire the 6 remaining Nexus 6 Andes? They're a good deal smarter than the Grozzi Corporation's old W-4.
But I hunt them, he said. This way, with a reversion clause on the owl, someone would be hunting me. And he did not like the idea of being stalked. He had seen the effect on androids. It brought about certain notable changes, even in them. Rachel said, all right. We'll yield on that. You can will the owl to your heirs, but we insist on getting the complete brood. If you can't agree to that, go on back to San Francisco and admit to your superiors in the department that the Voigt Kampf scale, at least as administered by you, can't distinguish an Andy from a human being. And then look for another job. Give me some time, Rick said.
Okay,
Rachel said.
We'll leave you in here, where it's comfortable.
She examined her wristwatch. 30 minutes, Eldon Rosen said. He and Rachel filed toward the door of the room silently. They had said what they intended to say, he realized. The rest lay in his lap. As Rachel started to close the door after herself and her uncle, Rick said starkly, "You managed to set me up perfectly. You have it on tape that I missed on you. You know that my job depends on the use of the Voigt Kampf scale. And you own that goddamn owl."
Your owl, dear, Rachel said. Remember?
We'll tie your home address around its leg and have it fly down to San Francisco. It'll meet you there when you get off work. It, he thought. She keeps calling the owl it. Not her. Just a second, he said. Pausing at the door, Rachel said,
"You've decided?"
"I want," he said, opening his briefcase, "to ask you one more question from the Voigt Kampf scale. Sit down again." Rachel glanced at her uncle. He nodded and she grudgingly returned, seating herself as before. "What's this for?" she demanded, her eyebrows lifted in distaste and wariness. He perceived her skeletal tension, noted it professionally. Presently, he had the pencil of light trained on her right eye and the adhesive patch again in contact with her cheek. Rachel stared into the light rigidly, the expression of extreme distaste still manifest. "My briefcase," Rick said as he rummaged for the Voigt Kampf forms. "Nice, isn't it? Department issue."
"Well, well," Rachel said remotely.
"Baby hide," Rick said. He stroked the black leather surface of the briefcase. 100% genuine human baby hide. He saw the two dial indicators gyrate frantically, but only after a pause. The reaction had come, but too late. He knew the reaction period down to a fraction of a second, the correct reaction period. There should have been none. "Thanks, Miss Rosen," he said, and gathered together the equipment again. he had concluded his retesting. That's all.
You're leaving? Rachel asked.
Yes, he said. I'm satisfied.
Cautiously, Rachel said, What about the other 9 subjects?
The scale has been adequate in your case, he answered. I can extrapolate from that. It's clearly still effective. To Eldon Rosen, who slumped morosely by the door of the room, he said, Does she know? Sometimes they didn't. False memories had been tried various times, generally in the mistaken idea that through them, reactions to testing would be altered. Eldon Rosen said,
No.
We programmed her completely. But I think toward the end, she suspected. To the girl, he said, You guessed when he asked for one more try. Pale, Rachel nodded fixedly.
Don't be afraid of him, Eldon Rosen told her. You're not an escaped android on Earth illegally. You're the property of the Rosen Association, used as a sales device for prospective emigrants.
He walked to the girl, put his hand comfortingly on her shoulder. At the touch, the girl flinched. He's right, Rick said. I'm not going to retire you, Miss Rosen. Good day. He started toward the door, then halted briefly. To the two of them, he said, Is the owl genuine? Rachel glanced swiftly at the elder Rosen.
He's leaving anyhow, Eldon Rosen said. It doesn't matter. The owl is artificial. There are no owls.
Rick muttered and stepped numbly out into the corridor. The two of them watched him go. Neither said anything. Nothing remained to say. So that's how the largest manufacturer of androids operates, Rick said to himself. Devious, and in a manner he had never encountered before. A weird and convoluted new personality type. No wonder law enforcement agencies were having trouble with the Nexus 6. The Nexus 6. He had now come up against it. Rachel, he realized. She must be a Nexus 6. I'm seeing one of them for the first time. And they damn near did it. They came awfully damn close to undermining the Voight-Kampff scale, the only method we have for detecting them. The Rosen Association does a good job. Makes a good try, anyhow, at protecting its products. And I have to face 6 more of them, he reflected, before I'm finished. He would earn the bounty money. Every cent. Assuming he made it through alive.
Chapter 6.
The TV set boomed. Descending the great empty apartment building's dust-stricken stairs to the level below, John Isidore made out now the familiar voice of Buster Friendly, burbling happily to his system-wide vast audience.
Ho-ho, folks! Zip, click, zip! Time for a brief note on tomorrow's weather. First, the eastern seaboard of the USA Mongoose satellite reports that fallout will be especially pronounced toward noon, and then will taper off. So all you dear folks who will be venturing out ought to wait until afternoon, huh? And speaking of waiting, it's now only 10 hours till that big piece of news, my special expose. Tell your friends to watch. I'm revealing something that'll amaze you. Now, you might guess that it's just the usual...
As Isidore knocked on the apartment door, the television died immediately into non-being. It had not merely become silent. It had stopped existing, scared into its grave by his knock. He sensed, behind the closed door, the presence of life beyond that of the TV. His straining faculties manufactured, or else picked up, a haunted, tongueless fear by someone retreating from him, someone blown back to the farthest wall of the apartment in an attempt to evade him.
"Hey," he called. "I live upstairs. I heard your TV. Let's meet. Okay?"
He waited, listening. No sound and no motion. His words had not pried the person loose.
"I brought you a cube of margarine," he said,
standing close to the door in an effort to speak through its thickness.
"My name's J.R. Isidore, and I work for the well-known animal vet Mr. Hannibal Sloat. You've heard of him. I'm reputable. I have a job. I drive Mr. Sloat's truck."
The door meagerly opened, and he saw within the apartment a fragmented and misaligned, shrinking figure, a girl who cringed and slunk away and yet held on to the door, as if for physical support. Fear made her seem ill. It distorted her body lines, made her appear as if someone had broken her, and then, with malice, patched her together badly. Her eyes, enormous, glazed over fixedly as she attempted to smile. He said, with sudden understanding,
"You thought no one lived in this building. You thought it was abandoned."
Nodding, the girl whispered,
"Yes."
"But," Isidore said,
"it's good to have neighbors. Heck, until you came along, I didn't have any."
And that was no fun, God knew.
"You're the only one?"
the girl asked.
"In this building, besides me?"
She seemed less timid now. Her body straightened, and with her hand she smoothed her dark hair. Now he saw that she had a nice figure, although small, and nice eyes markedly established by long black lashes. Caught by surprise, the girl wore pajama bottoms and nothing more. And as he looked past her, he perceived a room in disorder. Suitcases lay here and there, opened, their contents half spilled onto the littered floor. But this was natural. She had barely arrived.
"I'm the only one besides you," Isidore said. "And I won't bother you."
He felt glum. His offering, possessing the quality of an authentic old pre-war ritual, had not been accepted. In fact, the girl did not even seem aware of it. Or maybe she did not understand what a cube of margarine was for. He had that intuition. The girl seemed more bewildered than anything else. Out of her depth and helplessly floating in now receding circles of fear.
"Good old Buster," he said,
trying to reduce her rigid postural stance.
"You like him? I watch him every morning and then again at night when I get home. I watch him while I'm eating dinner and then his late, late show until I go to bed. At least until my TV set broke."
"Who?" the girl began and then broke off. She bit her lip as if savagely angry, evidently at herself.
"Buster Friendly," he explained.
It seemed odd to him that this girl had never heard of Earth's most knee-slapping TV comic.
"Where did you come here from?"
he asked curiously.
"I don't see that it matters."
She shot a swift glance upward at him. Something that she saw seemed to ease her concern.
her body noticeably relaxed. "I'll be glad to receive company," she said, "later on when I'm more moved in. Right now, of course, it's out of the question."
"Why out of the question?"
He was puzzled. Everything about her puzzled him.
"Maybe," he thought, "I've been living here alone too long. I've become strange."
"They say chicken heads are like that." The thought made him feel even more glum.
"I could help you unpack," he ventured.
The door now had virtually shut in his face.
"And your furniture?"
The girl said,
"I have no furniture. All these things,"
she indicated the room behind her,
"they were here."
"They won't do," Isidore said. He could tell that at a glance. The chairs, the carpet, the tables, all had rotted away. They sagged in mutual ruin, victims of the despotic force of time and of abandonment. No one had lived in this apartment for years. The ruin had become almost complete. He couldn't imagine how she figured on living in such surroundings.
"Listen," he said earnestly, "if we go all over the building looking, we can probably find you things that aren't so tattered. A lamp from one apartment, a table from another."
"I'll do it," the girl said.
"Myself. Thanks."
"You'd go into those apartments alone?" He could not believe it.
"Why not?"
Again, she shuddered nervously, grimacing in awareness of saying something wrong. Isidore said,
"I've tried it. Once. After that, I just come home and go in my own place, and I don't think about the rest.
The apartments in which no one lives? Hundreds of them, and all full of the possessions people had, like family photographs and clothes. Those that died couldn't take anything, and those who emigrated didn't want to. This building, except for my apartment, is completely kippelized."
"Kippelized?"
She did not comprehend.
"Kippel is useless objects, like junk mail or match folders after you use the last match, or gum wrappers or yesterday's homeopape. When nobody's around, kippel reproduces itself. For instance, if you go to bed leaving any kippel around your apartment, when you wake up the next morning, there's twice as much of it. It always gets more and more."
"I see." The girl regarded him uncertainly, not knowing whether to believe him, not sure if he meant it seriously.
"There's the first law of kippel," he said. "Kippel drives out non-kippel. Like Gresham's law about bad money. And in these apartments, there's been nobody there to fight the kippel."
"So it has taken over completely," the girl finished. She nodded.
"Now I understand." "Your place here," he said, "this apartment you've picked, it's too kippelized to live in. We can roll the kippel factor back. We can do like I said, raid the other apts. But..."
He broke off.
"But what?"
Isidore said,
"We can't win."
"Why not?" The girl stepped into the hall, closing the door behind her. Arms folded self-consciously before her small, high breasts, she faced him, eager to understand. Or so it appeared to him, anyhow. She was at least listening.
"No one can win against kippel," he said, "except temporarily, and maybe in one spot. Like in my apartment, I've sort of created a stasis between the pressure of kippel and non-kippel, for the time being. But eventually, I'll die or go away, and then the kipple will again take over. It's a universal principle operating throughout the universe. The entire universe is moving toward a final state of total, absolute kippelization. He added, except, of course, for the upward climb of Wilbur Mercer.
The girl eyed him. I don't see any relation.
That's what Mercerism is all about.
Again, he found himself puzzled.
Don't you participate in fusion? Don't you own an empathy box?
After a pause, the girl said carefully, I didn't bring mine with me. I assumed I'd find one here.
But an empathy box, he said,
stammering in his excitement,
is the most personal possession you have. It's an extension of your body. It's the way you touch other humans. It's the way you stop being alone. But you know that. Everybody knows that. Mercer even lets people like me.
He broke off. But too late. He had already told her, and he could see by her face, by the flicker of sudden aversion, that she knew.
I almost passed the IQ test, he said in a low, shaky voice. I'm not very special, only moderately. Not like some, you see. But that's what Mercer doesn't care about.
As far as I'm concerned, the girl said, you can count that as a major objection to Mercerism. Her voice was clean and neutral. She intended only to state a fact, he realized. The fact of her attitude toward chicken heads.
I guess I'll go back upstairs, he said, and started away from her, his cube of margarine clutched.
It had become plastic and damp from the squeeze of his hand. The girl watched him go, still with the neutral expression on her face. And then she called, Wait! Turning, he said,
Why? I'll need you. Forgetting myself adequate furniture. From other apartments, as you said.
She strolled toward him, her bare upper body sleek and trim, without an excess gram of fat.
What time do you get home from work? You can help me then.
Isidore said,
Could you maybe fix dinner for us? If I brought home the ingredients? No, I have too much to do.
The girl shook off the requests effortlessly, and he noticed that, perceived it without understanding it. Now that her initial fear had diminished, something else had begun to emerge from her. Something more strange. And, he thought, deplorable. A coldness. Like, he thought, a breath from the vacuum between inhabited worlds. In fact, from nowhere. It was not what she did or said, but what she did not do and say.
Some other time, the girl said, and moved back toward her apartment door. Did you get my name? He said eagerly. John Isidore, and I work for... You told me who you work for.
She had stopped briefly at her door. Pushing it open, she said,
Some incredible person named Hannibal Sloat, who I'm sure doesn't exist outside your imagination. My name is...
She gave him one last warmthless glance as she returned to her apartment, hesitated, and said,
I'm Rachel Rosen.
Of the Rosen Association? He asked. The system's largest manufacturer of humanoid robots used in our colonization program? A complicated expression instantly crossed her face, fleetingly, gone at once.
No,
she said.
I never heard of them.
I don't know anything about it.
More of your chicken head imagination, I suppose.
John Isidore and his personal, private empathy box.
Poor Mr. Isidore.
But your name suggests...
My name, the girl said, is Pris Stratton. That's my married name. I always use it. I never use any other name but Pris. You can call me Pris.
She reflected, then said,
No, you'd better address me as Miss Stratton, because we don't really know each other.
At least I don't know you. The door shut after her, and he found himself alone in the dust-strewn, dim hall. Chapter 7
Well, so it goes,
J.R. Isidore thought as he stood clutching his soft cube of margarine.
Maybe she'll change her mind about letting me call her Pris. And possibly, if I can pick up a can of pre-war vegetables, about dinner, too. But maybe she doesn't know how to cook, he thought suddenly. Okay, I can do it. I'll fix dinner for both of us. And I'll show her how so she can do it in the future if she wants. She'll probably want to once I show her how. As near as I can make out, most women, even young ones like her, like to cook. It's an instinct.
Ascending the darkened stairs, he returned to his own apartment.
She's really out of touch, he thought as he donned his white work uniform.
Even if he hurried, he'd be late to work and Mr. Sloat would be angry. But so what?
For instance, she's never heard of Buster Friendly. And that's impossible.
Buster is the most important human being alive, except, of course, for Wilbur Mercer.
But Mercer, he reflected, isn't a human being.
He evidently is an archetypal entity from the stars, superimposed on our culture by a cosmic template. At least, that's what I've heard people say. That's what Mr. Sloat says, for instance. And Hannibal Sloat would know. Odd that she isn't consistent about her own name, he pondered. She may need help.
Can I give her any help? He asked himself. A special? A chicken head? What do I know? I can't marry, and I can't emigrate, and the dust will eventually kill me. I have nothing to offer.
Dressed and ready to go, he left his apartment and ascended to the roof where his battered, used hover car lay parked. An hour later, in the company truck, he had picked up the first malfunctioning animal for the day, an electric cat. It lay in the plastic, dust-proof carrying cage in the rear of the truck and panted erratically.
You'd almost think it was real,
Isidore observed as he headed back to the Van Ness Pet Hospital, that carefully misnamed little enterprise which barely existed in the tough, competitive field of false animal repair. The cat, in its travail, groaned.
Wow, Isidore said to himself. It really sounds as if it's dying. Maybe its 10-year battery has shorted, and all its circuits are systematically burning out.
A major job. Milt Beauregrove, Van Ness Pet Hospital's repairman, would have his hands full.
And I didn't give the owner an estimate, Isidore realized gloomily. The guy simply thrust the cat at me, said it had begun failing during the night, and then I guess he took off for work.
Anyhow, all of a sudden, the momentary verbal exchange had ceased. The cat's owner had gone roaring up into the sky in his custom new model handsome hover car, and the man constituted a new customer. To the cat, Isidore said, "Can you hang on until we reach the shop?" The cat continued to wheeze. "I'll recharge you while we're en route," Isidore decided. He dropped the truck toward the nearest available roof and there, temporarily parked with the motor running, crawled into the back of the truck and opened the plastic dust-proof carrying cage, which, in conjunction with his own white suit and the name on the truck, created a total impression of a true animal vet picking up a true animal. The electric mechanism, within its compellingly authentic style gray pelt, gurgled and blew bubbles, its vid lenses glassy, its metal jaws locked together. This had always amazed him, these disease circuits built into false animals. The construct which he now held on his lap had been put together in such a fashion that when a primary component misfired, the whole thing appeared, not broken, but organically ill. "It would have fooled me," Isidore said to himself as he groped within the ersatz stomach fur for the concealed control panel. Quite small on this variety of false animal, plus the quick charge battery terminals. He could find neither. Nor could he search very long. The mechanism had almost failed. "If it does consist of a short," he reflected, "which is busy burning out circuits, then maybe I should try to detach one of the battery cables. The mechanism will shut down, but no more harm will be done. And then, in the shop, Milt can charge it back up." Deftly, he ran his fingers along the pseudo-bony spine. The cables should be about here. Damn expert workmanship. So absolutely perfect an imitation. Cables not apparent even under close scrutiny. Must be a wheelwright and carpenter product. They cost more, but look what good work they do. He gave up. The false cat had ceased functioning, so evidently the short, if that was what ailed the thing, had finished off the power supply and basic drivetrain. "That'll run into money," he thought pessimistically. Well, the guy evidently hadn't been getting the 3 times yearly preventive cleaning and lubricating, which made all the difference. Maybe this would teach the owner the hard way. Crawling back in the driver's seat, he put the wheel into climb position, buzzed up into the air once more, and resumed his flight back to the repair shop. Anyhow, he no longer had to listen to the nerve-wracking wheezing of the construct. He could relax. Funny, he thought. Even though I know rationally it's faked, the sound of a false animal burning out its drivetrain and power supply ties my stomach in knots. I wish, he thought painfully, that I could get another job. If I hadn't failed that IQ test, I wouldn't be reduced to this ignominious task with its attendant emotional byproducts. On the other hand, the synthetic sufferings of false animals didn't bother Milt Beauregrove or their boss, Hannibal Sloat. So maybe it's I, John Isidore said to himself. Maybe when you deteriorate back down the ladder of evolution as I have, when you sink into the tomb world slough of being a special, well,
best to abandon that line of inquiry. Nothing depressed him more than the moments in which he contrasted his current mental powers with what he had formerly possessed. Every day he declined in sagacity and vigor. He and the thousands of other specials throughout Terra, all of them moving toward the ash heap, turning into living kibble. For company, he clicked on the truck's radio and tuned for Buster Friendly's Odd Show, which, like the TV version, continued 23 unbroken warm hours a day. The additional 1 hour being a religious sign-off, 10 minutes of silence, and then a religious sign-on. "Glad to have you on the show again," Buster Friendly was saying. "Let's see, Amanda. It's been 2 whole days since we visited with you. Starting on any new picks, dear?"
"Well, I was going to do a pick yesterday, but, well, they wanted me to start at 7.
7 a.m.?" Buster Friendly broke in.
"Yes, that's right, Buster. It was 7 a.m.
Amanda Verner laughed her famous laugh, nearly as imitated as Buster's. Amanda Verner and several other beautiful, elegant, conically breasted foreign ladies from unspecified, vaguely defined countries, plus a few bucolic so-called humorists, comprised Buster's perpetual core of repeats. Women like Amanda Verner never made movies, never appeared in plays. They lived out their queer, beautiful lives as guests on Buster's unending show, appearing, Isadora had once calculated, as much as 70 hours a week. How did Buster Friendly find the time to tape both his Odd and Vid shows, Isadora wondered. And how did Amanda Verner find time to be a guest every other day, month after month, year after year? How did they keep talking? They never repeated themselves, not so far as he could determine. Their remarks, always witty, always new, weren't rehearsed. Amanda's hair glowed, her eyes glinted, her teeth shone. She never ran down, never became tired, never found herself at a loss as to a clever retort to Buster's bang-bang string of quips, jokes, and sharp observations. The Buster Friendly Show, telecast and broadcast over all Earth via satellite, also poured down on the emigrants of the colony planets. Practice transmissions beamed to Proxima had been attempted in case human colonization extended that far. Had the Solander 3 reached its destination, the travelers aboard would have found the Buster Friendly Show awaiting them. And they would have been glad. But something about Buster Friendly irritated John Isadore. One specific thing. In subtle, almost inconspicuous ways, Buster ridiculed the empathy boxes. Not once, but many times. He was, in fact, doing it right now. "No rock nicks on me," Buster prattled away to Amanda Verner. "And if I'm going up the side of a mountain, I want a couple of bottles of Budweiser beer along." The studio audience laughed, and Isadora heard a sprinkling of hand claps. "And I'll reveal my carefully documented exposé from up there. That exposé coming exactly 10 hours from now."
"And me too, darling," Amanda gushed. "Take me with you. I go along, and when they throw a rock at us, I protect you."
Again, the audience howled, and John Isadore felt baffled and impotent rage seep up into the back of his neck.
Why did Buster Friendly always chip away at Mercerism? No one else seemed bothered by it. Even the UN approved. And the American and Soviet police had publicly stated that Mercerism reduced crime by making citizens more concerned about the plight of their neighbors. Mankind needs more empathy, Titus Corning, the UN Secretary General, had declared several times. Maybe Buster is jealous, Isidore conjectured. Sure, that would explain it. He and Wilbur Mercer are in competition. But for what? Our minds, Isidore decided. They're fighting for control of our psychic selves. The empathy box on one hand, Buster's guffaws and off-the-cuff jibes on the other. I'll have to tell Hannibal Sloat that, he decided. Ask him if it's true. He'll know. When he had parked his truck on the roof of the Van Ness Pet Hospital, he quickly carried the plastic cage containing the inert false cat downstairs to Hannibal Sloat's office. As he entered, Mr. Sloat glanced up from a parts inventory page, his gray, seamed face rippling like troubled water. Too old to emigrate, Hannibal Sloat, although not special, was doomed to creep out his remaining life on Earth. The dust over the years had eroded him. It had left his features gray, his thoughts gray. It had shrunk him and made his legs spindly and his gait unsteady. He saw the world through glasses literally dense with dust. For some reason, Sloat never cleaned his glasses. It was as if he had given up. He had accepted the radioactive dirt, and it had begun its job long ago of burying him. Already it obscured his sight. In the few years he had remaining, it would corrupt his other senses, until at last only his bird-screech voice would remain. And then that would expire too. "What do you have there?" Mr. Sloat asked. "A cat with a short in its power supply." Isidore set the cage down on the document-littered desk of his boss. "Why show it to me?" Sloat demanded. "Take it down in the shop to Milt." However, reflexively, he opened the cage and tugged the false animal out. Once, he had been a repairman. A very good one. Isidore said, "I think Buster Friendly and Mercerism are fighting for control of our psychic souls." "If so," Sloat said, examining the cat, "Buster is winning." "He's winning now," Isidore said, "but ultimately he'll lose." Sloat lifted his head, peered at him. "Why?" "Because Wilbur Mercer is always renewed. He's eternal. At the top of the hill, he's struck down. He sinks into the tomb world, but then he rises inevitably. And us with him. So we're eternal too." He felt good speaking so well. Usually around Mr. Sloat, he stammered. Sloat said, "Buster is immortal, like Mercer. There's no difference." "How can he be? He's a man." "I don't know," Sloat said, "but it's true. They've never admitted it, of course." "Is that how come Buster Friendly can do 46 hours of show a day?" "That's right," Sloat said. "What about Amanda Verner and those other women?" "They're immortal too." "Are they a superior life form from another system?" "I've never been able to determine that for sure," Mr. Sloat said, still examining the cat. He now removed his dust-filmed glasses, peered without them at the half-open mouth.
As I have conclusively in the case of Wilbur Mercer, he finished almost inaudibly.
He cursed then, a string of abuse lasting what seemed to Isidore a full minute.
This cat, Sloat said finally, isn't false. I knew sometime this would happen, and it's dead.
He stared down at the corpse of the cat and cursed again. Wearing his grimy blue sailcloth apron, burly, pebble-skinned Milt Beauregrove appeared at the office door.
What's the matter? He said.
Seeing the cat, he entered the office and picked up the animal.
The chicken head, Sloat said, brought it in.
Never before had he used that term in front of Isidore.
If it was still alive, Milt said, we could take it to a real animal vet. I wonder what it's worth. Anybody got a copy of Sidney's?
Doesn't your insurance cover this?
Isidore asked Mr. Sloat. Under him, his legs wavered, and he felt the room begin to turn dark maroon, cast over with specks of green.
Yes, Sloat said finally, half snarling. But it's the waste that gets me. The loss of one more living creature. Couldn't you tell, Isidore? Didn't you notice the difference?
I thought, Isidore managed to say, it was a really good job. So good it fooled me. I mean, it seemed alive. And a job that good.
I don't think Isidore can tell the difference, Milt said mildly. To him, they're all alive, false animals included. He probably tried to save it. To Isidore, he said, what did you do? Try to recharge its battery? Or locate a short in it?
Yes, Isidore admitted.
It probably was so far gone it wouldn't have made it anyhow, Milt said. Let the chicken head off the hook, Han. He's got a point. The fakes are beginning to be darn near real, what with those disease circuits they're building into the new ones. And living animals do die. That's one of the risks in owning them. We're just not used to it because all we see are fakes.
The goddamn waste, Sloat said.
According to Mercer, Isidore pointed out, all life returns. The cycle is complete for animals, too. I mean, we all ascend with him. Die? Tell that to the guy who owned this cat, Mr. Sloat said.
Not sure if his boss was serious, Isidore said,
you mean I have to? But you always handle vid calls.
He had a phobia about the vid phone and found making a call, especially to a stranger, virtually impossible. Mr. Sloat, of course, knew this.
Don't make him, Milt said. I'll do it.
He reached for the receiver.
What's his number? I've got it here somewhere.
Isidore fumbled in his work smock pockets. Sloat said,
I want the chicken head to do it.
I can't use the vid phone,
Isidore protested, his heart laboring.
Because I'm hairy, ugly, dirty, stooped, snaggle-toothed, and gray. And also, I feel sick from the radiation. I think I'm going to die.
Milt smiled and said to Sloat, I guess if I felt that way, I wouldn't use the vid phone either.
Come on, Isidore. If you don't give me the owner's number, I can't make the call, and you'll have to.
He held out his hand amiably. "The chicken head makes it," Sloat said, "or he's fired."
He did not look either at Isidore or at Milt. He glared fixedly forward.
"Ah, come on," Milt protested.
Isidore said, I don't like to be called a chicken head.
I mean, the dust has done a lot to you too, physically. Although maybe not your brain, as in my case.
I'm fired, he realized. I can't make the call. And then all at once he remembered that the owner of the cat had zipped off to work. There would be no one home.
I guess I can call him, he said, as he fished out the tag with the information on it.
See, Mr. Sloat said to Milt. He can do it if he has to. Seated at the vidphone, receiver in hand, Isidore dialed.
Yeah, Milt said, but he shouldn't have to. And he's right. The dust has affected you. You're damn near blind, and in a couple of years you won't be able to hear.
Sloat said, It's got to you too, Borogrove. Your skin is the color of dog manure.
On the vid screen, a face appeared. A Metal Europaisha, somewhat careful-looking woman who wore her hair in a tight bun.
Yes, she said. Mrs. Pilsen?
Isidore said, terror spewing through him. He had not thought of it, naturally, but the owner had a wife, who, of course, was home.
I want to talk to you about your...
He broke off, rubbed his chin tick-wise.
Your cat.
Oh, yes, you picked up Horace, Mrs. Pilsen said.
Did it turn out to be pneumonitis? That's what Mr. Pilsen thought.
Isidore said, Your cat died.
Oh, no, God in heaven.
We'll replace it, he said. We have insurance.
He glanced toward Mr. Sloat. He seemed to concur.
The owner of our firm, Mr. Hannibal Sloat, he floundered.
We'll personally...
No, Sloat said. We'll give them a check. Sydney's list price.
We'll personally pick the replacement cat out for you,
Isidore found himself saying. Having started a conversation which he could not endure, he discovered himself unable to get back out. What he was saying possessed an intrinsic logic which he had no means of halting. It had to grind to its own conclusion. Both Mr. Sloat and Milt Borogrove stared at him as he rattled on.
Give us the specifications of the cat you desire. Color? Sex? Subtype? Such as Manx, Persian, Abyssinian?
Horace is dead, Mrs. Pilsen said.
He had pneumonitis, Isidore said. He died on the trip to the hospital. Our senior staff physician, Dr. Hannibal Sloat, expressed the belief that nothing at this point could have saved him. But isn't it fortunate, Mrs. Pilsen, that we are going to replace him? Am I correct?
Mrs. Pilsen, tears appearing in her eyes, said,
There is only one cat like Horace. He used to, when he was just a kitten, stand and stare up at us as if asking a question. We never understood what the question was. Maybe now he knows the answer.
Fresh tears appeared.
I guess we all will eventually.
An inspiration came to Isidore.
What about
an exact electric duplicate of your cat. We can have a superb handcrafted job by wheelwright and carpenter in which every detail of the old animal is